This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Local faith organizations, community groups, and even employers are coming together for a new project, working to create a healthier multicultural community here in La Crosse. The project hopes to increase awareness and understanding of the experience of La Crosse residents from a wide range of racial, cultural, and ethnic backgrounds. Joining us to talk about the effort and how it fits in with other efforts to support racial justice are Pat Lunny, a co-leader of the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community Project, Thomas Harris, Assistant Director of the Office of Multicultural Student Services at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, Maggie Shong, Social Justice Director for Giashia Incorporated, a Cultural Agency here in La Crosse, and Rebecca Schwartz, Director of Mission Impact at YWCA La Crosse. Pat, can you explain a little bit more about the purpose of creating a healthier multicultural community project?
You know, many of us got involved with Thomas a few years back, and Thomas had a vision that before he retired, he really wanted to change some of the conversations that were happening in La Crosse. One of the ideas was to bring a symposium here, but he wanted to prepare the community for those type of conversations. And so really this collaborative that we've put together has multiple facets. The one that's taking place this fall, though, is called Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community. And as part of that, Reggie Jackson and Frank Kaplan are going to come in from Milwaukee and help lead us. They're from Nurturing Diversity Partners. And they've led a lot of these type of conversations in Milwaukee, where they've brought together small group facilitators and then community leaders. And so we're doing some of the things similar to what they did. But one of the things that we decided early on from the guidance of our steering committee was we wanted to have paired small group facilitators. So in each of our small groups, there will be one white facilitator and one racially and ethnically diverse facilitator. They participated in 15 hours of training with Reggie and Fran, and so they will help facilitate these discussions in groups of six, so two facilitators and four community leaders. And so over the last, well, probably 4 months, we have, as a co-leader team, met individually with a lot of different organizations, really talking about the project, laying out what we hoped it would achieve, but then also finding out where it synced up with things they were already doing in their own organization. What we found is there's a tremendous amount of interest in having dialogues around things like race. And many of these discussions have taken place in the past in the individual institutions, but maybe less so as the whole community coming together. And so there's a great amount of excitement for that. In fact, when we went out to try to recruit 48 community leaders to participate in four sessions, 3 hours each, we kind of thought it would take 3 or 4 months, and we filled up within 3 weeks. So almost everyone we sat down and visited with said, yeah, I'm really interested in that. I'd like to be part of this. So that was a very exciting part to what will take place in October and November now.
Maggie, as another co-leader on this project, I wonder if you can talk more about, you know, why you feel like this work is needed in La Crosse and maybe why it's needed now.
I think it's definitely needed in La Crosse because even though we are a very small community, we are a majority a white community as well. And these conversations need to happen because there are many folks of color here and many folks of color who feel that they don't feel welcomed in this community. So to be able to better understand each other and to gauge into these conversations, it's really needed, but it's also very intimidating to have these conversations as well. And I think this is a great way to gauge into it.
Yeah, I wonder if you could talk more about how it might be intimidating to kind of engage in
yeah,
this.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's intimidating for, I think, white folks because it's kind of calling things out and using terms that could be a little defensive and then putting themselves, feeling that they have sort of something to put into this. And then intimidating for folks of color as well, because even though we've been having these conversations within ourselves and within our own communities, bringing it out to the greater, larger community is hard because we don't know what to expect from it, and we might get backlash, and we don't know what to expect.
Thomas, I wonder if you can explain how, you know, why you felt like these kind of conversations, this work was needed, especially in light of a lot of the events that are happening in 2020 with the Waking Up White community collaborative, learning collaborative.
Well, this is part of the Waking Up White, one of the components of it. But the thought process is this is different in a number of ways. In many cases, things are started in educational institutions or started by people of color. This started actually with white folks reading the book Waking Up White. And some of the colleagues on the panel can speak more about that. So that's one thing. And it didn't start in a really large organization. They didn't really know where it was going to take off, which direction it was going to end up going. And then eventually they connected with me because I knew the author, Debbie Irby, from the National White Privilege Conference over the years. I already had read a good part of the book. I was familiar with some of her works and so on. But the other thing is, this is really, it brings in people because of their individual passion and not so much because of the organizations that they're involved in. But it just happens to be that they're part of different organizations that might have a commitment to this. So, and then you have people of color being part of it more as guiders or taking part in different components, working cross-culturally or cross-races and so on, as opposed to the people of color really leading it. And it's important that white people in our community do the work and they learn how important that is, because it's very different when somebody hears it from me as a receiver being white versus somebody who's hearing it from somebody white speaking at different times. I also think the pairing that Pat was just speaking about with the facilitators, one being white and one being a person of color, is also pretty important. That way, white folks aren't speaking for people of color and people of color aren't speaking for white folks. We're speaking about our individual experiences. And that's what we own up to. We can't own up for anybody else's actions. So there's a number of different things going on at the same time, building momentum over time to bring in other folks. Because the more that people hear about this in our community, I think more people are more curious, and they can see the newness in it and the freshness in it and say, I want to be a part of this. So it's the reading the book, it's having the discussions with people that you know, it's the what Pat just spoke about with the deep dives and the facilitators doing that over two long weekends and so on. It's the public presentations by Fran and Reggie, which is eventually going to lead into hosting a White Privilege Symposium here in the city in October of next year, 2020.
That's Thomas Harris from UWL's Office of Multicultural Student Services, here with us today to talk about ways the La Crosse area can become a healthier multicultural community. He's joined by Maggie Shong and Pat Lunny from the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community Project and Rebecca Schwartz from YWCA La Crosse. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Pat, I want to return to this idea that Thomas introduced, that it is white members of our community that need to engage in this work. And this is an issue that you had brought up in a previous conversation we had before this show. And I wonder if you want to expand about, you know, why that is.
It really takes some intentional work to come to that conclusion. For many of us, in our daily life, we don't really have to deal with race. If you ask, you know, what is your race, we maybe know on a form to fill out that we're white or Caucasian, but when you ask someone what their identity is, very seldom do we put down our race. And if you ask people of color, that's one of the first things they do. And you find that for people who are marginalized, that is often something that they come into a room with, and Maggie touched on that a little bit, is where are you most comfortable? Well, you're most comfortable with people that look like you, sound like you, that have a similar upbringing. And that with my involvement, Rebecca's involvement in La Crosse area showing up for racial justice, we started a book club about 4 years ago and just started reading books and then just sharing discussions around what those books were teaching us and then what we would do about that. And that brought Thomas into our circle about a year ago. And he talked about this idea of bringing the White Privilege Symposium. But he also talked about, that white men almost never do this work, that it's usually centered around women. And that really resonated with me. I went and visited with him afterwards and just started finding out what are some of the ideas, to do this right. And he's provided some great guidance, but he also stated this is work that we have to do as white people. And if every one of us went out and tried to rely on someone of color to give us the answers, that's not what's going to happen. And that's what's so powerful about the book Waking Up White, is it's really one person's experience and one person's personal transformation. But the extent that Debbie Irving goes through that learning for herself and unlearning is really a great roadmap. And that's why that book has been chosen as really a starting point for so many of us in the community. And it's been very well received. It's going to be part of the library read next summer, in the first few months before the White Privilege Symposium. But for me as an individual, this is something the more I learn, the more I learn that I don't know. And one of the authors that wrote the book White Fragility, Robin DiAngelo, has a great video out. In fact, if you go to our website, laxwakingupwhite.com, it's on the front page, and it's the title of it is Why I'm Not a Racist is Only Half the Story. And so much of the picture of what racism is overt racism. It's an individual who's conscious and intentional on doing something to someone else. So much so that if that's our only definition, then if somebody says you're a racist, we're going to get really defensive. And what each of these learnings teaches you is that you probably should say, well, yeah, I probably am. Well, tell me more. And in doing that, you open up a discussion and you recognize that most of racism is unconscious, most of it is systemic, and most of it is things we're not even thinking about. But then it reduces our defensiveness, and then you can have a conversation. And really, it's much more on a spectrum. It's not either you are racist or you aren't, and that creates so much difficulty for people of color to have conversations or even for white people to have conversations. And so that's a bit of a long answer, but it's a really complicated issue, and all the things that we learned in our upbringing that you have to kind of look at and relearn, that's not easy work. And so this whole process is much more about inner transformation than it is anything else. And that's how we hope to have many of these conversations in our community. And so far, on every step that we've advanced this collaborative, it's really come together well, and people have a real willingness and interest in having these conversations if they can do it in kind of a safe way.
Yeah, Rebecca, I wonder what your perception is on just the awareness of kind of the need to have these conversations in our community, especially among white residents of our community. I mean, is there recognition of the privilege that comes with being white in a community like La Crosse?
Well, I guess I can only speak for myself. And I guess I would respond to that with, I'm very seldom aware of when white supremacy shows up in my own life. And it's been through the great gift and sometimes painful gift of friends and family and racially diverse colleagues who've brought that to my attention. And so what I'm really excited about with these deep dives is the opportunity for people to come forward, to come together and say, I'm willing to explore the things that I don't know I don't know. And I'm willing to do that in a way that is safe, but also where we can take a risk and we can be brave. So that's what I'm most looking forward to.
Yeah, Rebecca, can you give some examples of some of the different topics you hope to touch on in these small group conversations?
So in the morning of the first deep dive, Fran and Reggie are coming to give a to do a presentation on unconscious bias. That's the one for October. And so in the afternoon, the deep dives will have an opportunity to sit and really unpack that topic in a much more personal, small group setting. And so that's what the topics will be. But the beauty of the deep dives is sort of the structure. So I went through the facilitator training a few weeks ago, and the part of it that I'm just really looking forward to being in a space with people and being able to do this is that there's a chance to be listened to. So everyone will have an equal opportunity. Everyone in those small groups that Pat was talking about, where there's like six of us, we'll all have a chance to respond to information, respond to topics like unconscious bias, like what does that look like for me? What do I not know? And then we all have a chance to be listened to. And that's really powerful. When we did the facilitator training, I think that was the most powerful thing that my small group went through, was just the power of being listened to, especially on a topic that can be really, like Maggie said, triggering for everybody at the table for different reasons. So, and then the other really cool part is that the facilitators are also participants to this process. So I, as a facilitator, am not standing back with all of the knowledge or all of the know-how. I get to participate and I get to grow and be a part of the process with everyone else. So that's what I think is really the key element of these deep dives that I think is going to be the most impactful for our community members.
Maggie, you know, part of the kind of mission statement for this project is to, bring awareness, understanding, respect, empathy for the lived realities of people from a wide range of racial, cultural, and ethnic backgrounds. And I'm wondering if you can kind of expand on what those lived realities might look like, some of the topics that you're hoping are kind of a part of this conversation for people who maybe haven't thought about this.
I'm hoping folks will come in with sympathy and empathy. I think just even though you don't know these experiences that people of color and folks of color have gone through, you can be there and acknowledge that these are real experiences and these are hurtful experiences that have happened in La Crosse specifically, because I think a lot of folks and white folks are sort of blindsided to that. They don't recognize that these things do happen to folks of color. Just because that hasn't happened to white folks, it doesn't mean that they don't happen to folks of color. And it's something that's sort of painful to continuously talk about and to continuously share things that have happened to you. But then to be able to say these things and be validated and say that folks care about you and that we don't want these things to happen anymore in our community and we're working on this to be better is really assuring.
Mm-hmm. And Pat, you mentioned that there was a process of kind of recruiting people to be a part of this. And I wonder if you could explain kind of who you were kind of hoping to recruit to be a part of this project.
So when we first started out, we really wanted to find facilitators that could really add to this process. And we were told by a person of color that you're going to have a really hard time getting people to participate. They're burnt out. They're constantly asked to do this work, constantly asked to come to a meeting next week to help us understand inclusion and diversity, be on our board so we can have some diversity, help me understand this situation. And that's a large burden. And so one of the things that we started discussing early on is, okay, how do we do this in a way that recognizes that if somebody is going to share their lived experience, there's value in that. And so the project that we put together included fundraising, grant writing, but one of the main premises was that we were going to pay a stipend to our small group facilitators to facilitate these conversations and to recognize their lived experience. I don't think that in itself changed perspective. People aren't doing this for the money, but they recognized, hey, somebody gets it, that this is tough. And to share these experiences constantly is something that, if there's value perceived in that, and we changed that perspective, not just for this one event, but for going forward, that can be a profound difference. So at each step of this, you're really nervous on whether you're going to do this right or wrong. Are people going to come and be part of it? Aren't they? We had 42 people come to the informational sessions for the facilitator training. 24 of them were racially or ethnically diverse. We had 35 apply for what was 16 positions at the time. That was a tough thing to decide who's pouring out their life and soul, who's going to be selected and who isn't. But Rebecca had such a great idea because as we were wrestling with that, she said, is there a way that you can offer the training to everyone, even though not everyone will be hired to be a small group facilitator for the deep dives? And we pursued that. Fran and Reggie came with extra people to make that possible. So it was kind of one of those relief things that, okay, yeah, this was a better way to go. This doesn't, take only some of the people. It allows everyone to work on their own, skill development. So we bumped the number up from 16 to 24. And then we had to go start looking for the deep dive participants. And we really thought that would be tough. But we started to see that if you sit down with people and you spend an hour with them and you just start talking about what it is you want to accomplish and then ask them what they're already doing that syncs up with that and what their thoughts are on getting involved, that you move into a different realm of creating the type of conversation you're looking to really have in the end at the deep dives. And so the whole process, I think, has been extremely valuable to bring people together, but to also amplify the voices of people of color. I mean, through these meetings, people shared stories that are powerful of what happens for them in La Crosse. And with their permission, we were able to bring those stories to groups like Rotary or to the Criminal Justice Management Council and just say, like as Debbie Irving points out in her book, this isn't about intent. You can have the best intentions in the world. What's the impact? And if that impact has happened consistently, are you going to be someone that says, I'm willing to stay in this community and work to be in this community, or are you going to be someone who leaves? And for a lot of people that come to UWL, they end up, their experience leads them elsewhere. For those that have stayed, some of them have stayed, and they're real upfront on saying, I'm staying here, but I'm actively working to create the community I want. And so those are powerful discussions then when you're going to talk to community leaders, because then they start to see that this is maybe more of a reverse mentorship, an opportunity to come outside of their organization and go meet with some people that can share a lived experience that their own employees probably will be very reluctant to share, and do so in, it is a safe environment, but it's a safe place to become uncomfortable, because you have to become uncomfortable if you're really doing this work. So that part's been very encouraging. I wish we had the capacity to do it for 100 people, because I think we could have gotten 100 people involved real easily, but we're at 48. We've got a great core group of people coming in from private sector, public sector, informal leaders, formal leaders. And so a large part of that has been, big selling point has been the quality of the facilitators that have come to this process.
Yeah, Thomas, do you want to add something here?
Even prior to what Pat just said, back in January, we had three sessions, January, February. We had three sessions to invite people to the whole idea of doing this as a community project over time, talking about all three elements. And during that time, 125, 130 people showed up in total through those three sessions. Each person got a free book and so on. So throughout the process, people have been reading that book, including the facilitators, including the people who are going to participate in the deep dives throughout this process, along with different organizations would have an individual who got linked to this, and they were connected to their organization to buy books in bulk at a cheaper rate and so on. So about 2 months ago, we got a note from Debbie Irving that at least 1,200 books have been purchased through the setup that we've arranged through the project. So it's got to be quite a few more since then, you know. But that helps to put out the word, to bring in the facilitators and to bring in the people that might want to participate in the deep dives. The hope is that that will also propel people to want to do more in this process. And those individuals will be linked to organizations that will purchase the book in bulk to get their organizations to read it. So more people will be in a better place when the White Privilege Symposium happens. One component we haven't spoken about that we're getting ready to reconnect with because of the changeover in the library, with the public library here, we're looking to do this in some kind of way with La Crosse Reads. Maybe starting, maybe beginning of August, that kind of time frame, knowing that there's going to be 6 or 8 weeks of school from September to the time that the symposium happens. So that way, if professors, instructors, maybe even the high school folks in school districts in the neighboring areas, they may want to read the book in order to be prepared to come to the symposium. The last thing I want to mention right now is I keep bringing up the book because Debbie Irving is going to be one of the three keynotes. That's pretty much guaranteed right now. So,
Thomas Harris from UWL's Office of Multicultural Student Services is here with us today to talk about a new initiative to raise awareness of the experience of La Crosse residents from different racial, cultural, and ethnic backgrounds. Also joining us are Pat Lunny and Maggie Shong from the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community Project and Rebecca Schwartz from YWCA La Crosse. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation on the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community Project. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community Project. 90% of residents in the city of La Crosse are white, and some community leaders feel that majority means the experiences of residents from different racial, cultural, or ethnic backgrounds isn't always considered or understood. A new project by community groups, faith organizations, and even employers in the La Crosse area hopes to increase awareness and inspire reflection among residents. Joining us to talk about the effort today are Pat Lunny, a co-leader of the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community Project, Thomas Harris, Assistant Director of the Office of Multicultural Student Services at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, Maggie Shong, Social Justice Director for Giashia Incorporated, and Rebecca Schwartz, Director of Mission Impact at YWCA-La Crosse. Rebecca, I wonder if you can maybe talk about what a healthy multicultural community looks like. You know, that is the kind of the goal of this project, and I wonder if you can share what maybe some markers of a healthy community looks like in this area.
So I grew up here in La Crosse and have been gone for a number of years. My husband and I just moved back a couple years ago, and so for me, it's coming back, being back in town means getting to know a city that I thought I knew as a child. But now as an adult and coming to it with a lens that I didn't have before, a racial justice lens. And so learning about how my community members, my neighbors, and my friends and colleagues have really experienced a different La Crosse than I remember growing up. where they don't feel welcome, they don't feel represented, whether it's in a business or a work setting. And so for me, a healthier multicultural community is exactly what I want. It's what I want my son to grow up in. I want a lacrosse where everyone feels at home and everyone feels like they belong. And the fact that my friends and neighbors don't feel that way isn't okay with me. And so that's what I'm ultimately working for, and that's what ultimately brings me to the table here and at YWCA Lacrosse.
Maggie, I would also pose the same question to you, of what you feel like a healthier multicultural community would look like here in Lacrosse.
Yeah, I think that's really hard to be able to imagine, especially. But for me, I think it's being able to fully be ourselves and being able to walk around and see that we're represented. And if any, it's, you don't even have to be alike or even dress alike, but just being able to understand that there are differences within folks and that you should know about these differences and be able to understand them. And even though these differences aren't like you, it's okay. For me specifically, I think Hmong folks have been in lacrosse for a while now, and still a lot of people don't know about us, and that's a huge issue, especially, and then that also turns into not being welcomed here, and then into hearing racist things in the community as well. So I think there's a lot to work on, but it's something that we can continue doing to be better.
Thomas, I wonder how you see, you know, have we had these kinds of conversations in lacrosse in the past? And are there, you know, different projects or initiatives that have maybe paved the way for this new project?
I guess on a personal level, I guess I've seen quite a bit and been a part of quite a bit over the last, I don't know, 20 to 30 years. I think some of the things that come to mind when you talk about collaboration, in particularly working in the area of oppression, eliminating oppression, looking at equity, and talking about different cultural, historical types of things. I look at things I've been involved in would be moving the Martin Luther King program from UWL into the community. That was right around 2005. Some people may be aware of this, particularly if they've been here for a while. A little bit different. We started an NAACP chapter shortly after that, and around 2008, I think. And it kind of fizzled out. And I think part of that is because of limited numbers of Black folks living in the community. If you have limited populations, then you have those individuals doing many, many things and being pulled left and right, not just for work things, but also for volunteer things. And that doesn't even speak to the things that you really, really want to like put your commitment and time into. I think even in some ways, hosting the National White Privilege Conference in 2010, those are some things that come to mind. I think years before that, thinking about Jay Scott, who's works with the foundation at UWL, there was a program called, I think it was Valuing Diversity, or it was something like that. And that was a bunch of different programs happening, dealing with diversity happening at UWL, but the whole community could come to it. I think, to me, one of the biggest things that we could be doing is not to be territorial in what we do. And I think the more that we can do where it's open to the public, it's free, And we work together to pay for whatever we need to pay for it to be free admission, so the people can get the education, the awareness, the preparation over time. With this and some other things too, the better position that we'll be. I would add that I think what's really, really creative about this and really different, you know, or it's turning out to be, because we're kind of creating as we go. And it's something where everybody is invited to participate in. We've had conversations about, okay, is this just for the people who have resources? And what about the people who are living on the street? You know, we're talking about how to get them maybe to read the book. And then at the same time, how do we get them to the symposium possibly? You know, so it's not just about the people who are in positions of authority, power, and influence, but it's everything from that to the people who really don't have very much and everybody in between. And looking at that, that's what's really interesting when you talk about equity and looking at issues of privilege. The last thing that I would say, this is just such a new thing, and that's what makes it so inviting and impressive, and the curiosity builds up where I think people really just want to be a part of it. A couple of things that would be really great to see as a healthier community is, I don't think any community is going to be the healthiest. At no time. There's always going to be stuff going on. But I like to see more people of color leading and being in top positions in business, in our educational systems, not just people working on issues of equity and inclusion, but also maybe being president of a university or being the superintendent of the school district, or being a major player at Wisconsin Public Radio. I mean, I kind of look at the whole thing, you know, and so on. And then at the same time, we're getting to the point where we're finally paying our students for internships. You know, and you would think that that would not be such a big thing, but to have students always doing stuff for free labor, even though we call it an internship and people are getting experience, I guess I just have a problem with that. You know, so those are a couple of things. Thank you.
Yeah. Pat, I want to kind of stay on this issue of funding that Thomas introduced, and I'm curious what the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community, what funding needs this project has had and how the group has addressed those.
Well, we've got a couple other co-leaders and then a couple other really helpful folks that have been involved. So Mary Nelson has really been the person that started this dialogue with Fran and Reggie several years ago and brought them here a couple of different times. And then Ron Malzer has been involved with the process too. Those two folks have been the major force behind grant writing and talking to people from a fund standpoint. And so it's really come out of those discussions oftentimes that other people said, yeah, we want to get involved. The local bishop of the ELCA church provided the book to 55 of his pastors, and now that's having a ripple effect. And I think that's an important consideration. When we met with the library, they were a little concerned that, if we start a year ahead of when the read is, are we going to see the book out there and reach a number and then fall off? And we've structured this whole thing around the opposite of that happening, that we want to plant the book in different organizations, different situations where people are reading it to just see, okay, where else will this fit? And so building a trajectory over several years where the people that have read it then become facilitators, or they become parts of discussions or part of the library process so that the growth increases exponentially. That being said, there's about 12 major funders, though, including the La Crosse Community Foundation, the Robert and Eleanor Frankie Charitable Fund, that made this their biggest award this past spring. That freed us up then, along with the other 10, 11 grants, to really put our focus into the facilitators, put our focus into making this bigger than we thought we might make it initially, and then really focusing our efforts on having the time to spend with community leaders talking about it. So that's a tremendous relief. Anyone that's done fundraising knows that that can consume most of your time trying to get to having enough money then to go do the work you're trying to do. And in this case, we raised a tremendous amount of money, enough for what we needed to then go out and do this the best way we saw possible.
I also know that your website lists Quick Trip in Gunderson and Mayo Health Systems as also kind of partners. I don't know if they're financial contributors on this project. And, you know, I think that's interesting, and I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how maybe, you know, non-traditional organizations are kind of coming into this this realm.
We thought it was important that we go to employers, too, because their HR departments have a tremendous ability to impact not only hiring people of color. That's a first step that I think most people focus on, but they miss the step on how are you going to create culture in your organization that allows people of color to stay and feel welcomed and feel supported. So Gunderson Foundation, Mayo Clinic Health System Foundation contributed financially through grants. Quick Trip gave us several gift cards that were then used for having, a variety of things available at all of these different meetings that we've got. That was invaluable. But in each case, they committed to having people participate in the program, whether it's the public presentations or the deep dives. That's the more formal side. But then when you look at places like New Horizons, where they were the first group to buy the bulk purchase of the book, and brought it in, and all their employees read the book. Franciscan Sisters, same thing, a grant provider, but they formed an affinity group, not necessarily a book club. Every organization's doing this a little bit different. That's where we haven't been involved in dictating any of those parameters. We just say, where do you think this would fit in most, and how can you take this forward? And then the resources are really at the website, debbieirving.com. They're in the book, but one of our steering committee members, Amanda Strosel, and her digital team counterpart, Alyssa Gostancic, are now meeting with some of those groups that early on started reading the book and just going out to find out, okay, how did you incorporate this? And then what can we learn from what your experience was and bring that to the library read?
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're talking with community leaders about a new project working to create a healthier multicultural community here in La Crosse. We're here with Pat Lunny and Maggie Shong from the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community Project, Thomas Harris from UWL's Office of Multicultural Student Services, and Rebecca Schwartz from YWCA La Crosse. With so many different groups kind of engaging in this work, Maggie, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you hope to see, these conversations influencing, you know, different organizations, different institutions, from, you know, things like healthcare systems to schools and et cetera.
Yeah, I definitely hope that this conversation will spark many conversations that will be definitely hard, but I think as well as enlightening, because people, I would imagine a lot of folks have not talked about whiteness before. And I think it's really hard. And I hope that they spark these conversations with their own family members as well, because those conversations are the hardest to have, is the ones where you love these people the most and you want to have a really good conversation with them. And then spread out to the larger community with folks that they work with, folks that they hang out with.
Yeah, and Rebecca, What advice would you give with people who are, you know, maybe hearing this conversation today about kind of engaging this work, you know, different opportunities to learn more?
I would say, so if people are out there and they're wondering, is this for me? My answer is a resounding yes. Yes, it is. Be brave. Be bold. If we don't start confronting racism in our community, in ourselves, and in our institutions, we will never get anywhere. We can, and this is an opportunity to do that as a community together. And so my advice is learn more. Go to the website, laxwakingupwhite.com, and check out all of the three different kind of actions that all fall under the larger collaborative. There's so many ways for people to connect with this, whether it's the public presentations or the book read, the symposium next fall. I guarantee there's a way that if you want to connect with what's going on, you can, and you should.
Pat, what do you feel like meaningful change looks like for this initiative? You know, what measures are you going to be looking to see if this project worked?
Well, having worked in the corporate world for a long time, I'm very familiar with how often, you know, people look at measuring things and defining outcomes. One of the most refreshing things about being part of this process is being in meetings with Thomas and him encouraging us to, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's go out, let's have these conversations. Let's see where this process brings us. And that's been tremendously liberating, but also I think it's gotten us to a better outcome. It certainly has been a very enjoyable process to be part of. But that also being said, we do have definite outcomes that we want to get to. We want to have a much more engaged community in having these conversations, and we want to leverage everyone that either we meet with or continues to participate in, as Rebecca said, being brave. I mean, being comfortable with being uncomfortable, but being curious and being a learner and finding out, you know, more about other people in our community. So those are less hard, measurable points, and they're much more points that take time and take a collective approach. And that is probably one of the best things about this whole process. There are hundreds of people involved, a collective approach to changing the community. So while we definitely have goals and things that we want to achieve, I think it becomes much more about the process and engaging people in stories as opposed to positions.
Yeah, Thomas, I'm curious what your thoughts are. If this project is successful, you know, what you hope the community looks like in maybe 10 years from now?
I think the process that we've been speaking about, it is going to create new relationships across the community. I mean, Pat has went out and did most of the one-on-ones to bring people into the deep dives. That's the beginning of it, you know? And all of the time that people are gonna spend together on those weekends in the deep dives, and the facilitators going through the training and involved in that, that's all having people spend time together speaking about situations of race, institutionally, personally, organizational-wide, the way it has been in their lives, the way it is now, and the way that we want to see the future. To me, it's also hopefully going to prepare folks better in our community to be thinking about it in their daily lives, and particularly in their workplaces as decisions are being made. I know being a person of color, that's always on my mind. You know, it happens naturally. And particularly with me working in multicultural student services and being part of the diversity council and things like that, it's a natural thing. I think for many folks, and particularly many white folks, the inclination doesn't even come up, you know? So it's things like that I think are gonna happen over time, where And when you combine that with the number of people who might be in a better position to have those thoughts, to question some things, because sometimes we're making our decisions based on efficiency versus what really, really matters, and the people who are involved and looking at that, I'm hoping in the long run that more thought will be put into things and more care will be put into things. And people will want to come here because they hear what's happening in La Crosse when you talk about the topics that we're speaking about.
Thomas Harris, Pat Lunny, Maggie Shong, and Rebecca Schwartz are here from the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community Project. They joined us today to talk about upcoming events to raise awareness about the experiences of La Crosse residents from different racial, ethnic, and cultural backgrounds. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.